Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Emma Freivogel. Emma is the founder and CEO of Radical Recruit, a pioneering charity that supports companies in recruiting talent from a diverse range of backgrounds, including individuals with prior contact to the criminal justice system, victims of domestic violence, and homelessness, among other barriers to work. She is also the co-founder of Be Radical, a profit-for-good consultancy that supports job seekers from similar communities in securing more senior and skilled appointments, often within those same companies. Be Radical also assists businesses in laying the foundations of success and reimagining their usual ways of working through training, workshops, strategy sessions, audits, advisory services, and early careers recruitment. By collaborating with Radical brands, businesses not only diversify their talent pool and teams, but also enhance their social value. Emma's leadership is driven by a commitment to equality and social justice, aiming to create inclusive opportunities in the labor market and transform recruitment practices so they are welcoming and fair. Emma Freivogel, am I saying that right?
You did. First time you didn't even check with me. I'm well impressed. I don't think anyone in the history of my lifetime has managed to get my surname right the first go.
I'm practicing. Well, I'm glad we're finally doing this.
Yeah, it's great to meet you, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny because when I first approached you about being on the podcast, you were like, are you sure? Are you sure you want me to come on the show? Because what we do is pretty different to what you might expect. So can you explain like how you're, because you've got a business and you've got a B Corp as well.
No. So that's all right. So I've got two hats on today. So I originally founded a community interest company, which is a useless legal structure, except if you want to get like a charitable project, you know, off the ground very quickly. So in October 2019, I founded Radical Recruit, and that was a social enterprise that supported people who were furthest from the labor market to find jobs that sort of aligned with their recruitment preferences and would make really great use of their many skills and would offer sort of places of work where they could really belong and opportunities sort of to progress their careers. And what we did was we wrap everyone in support, the candidate and the client, to ensure that the candidates were work and interview ready and the clients were what we call sort of radical ready. So they'd really thought about the recruitment processes that our candidates would go into, as well as things like how to start them really well and support them to develop and flourish in their careers. So that organization sort of started out very accidentally. I quit my job. I actually got sacked, Mark.
Okay.
I was working for another organization who did similar work, but just with female ex-offenders. And that was sort of like my, you know, that's what propelled me into action. So five years on, we're now a fully fledged charity. And we work with lots of businesses, predominantly sort of big corporates who have entry-level recruitment needs and sort of wanting to diversify their talent pipelines. And then we also have Be Radical, which is kind of born out of necessity. So that's the aspiring B Corp that you've got in your head, and also the Profit for Good that is the lead sponsor for Radical. And that business was born out of necessity, really, because what we realized was there's no shortage of like radical talent. So those people I talked about who I started the charity for, who will let you sort of get them from A, not knowing what they're very good at or what they want to do from a career perspective, to B, able to take themselves to market or be represented in front of our employers. The challenge was always finding employers who, were turning their diversity rhetoric, their policy into recruitment practice that meant that our, you know, radical talent had a fair go if they dared apply. So that business supports organizations to look at the really fundamental things like policy and process, recruitment, ESG, CSR strategy, as well as capacity building the teams that then go and like have to do the grunt work essentially once the strategy's been set.
Emma, let me just pause here for a second before we get too far along, because I just want to really understand and appreciate the the candidates you're representing. So you can you say more about and give examples of the people you mentioned furthest from the labor market that you're trying to encourage these corporates to hire?
Yeah, certainly. So we work with two really distinct communities, people who should enjoy protections under the law, but very often don't. So think about your global majority or BAME communities, women, disabled folk, the LGBTQIA plus community. That's a real mouthful, isn't it? These types of individuals who should enjoy protections, but very often don't because they don't get a foot in the door into the labour market. So that's very, very, That's one of the focuses. And then the other focus is people who've had usually like adverse life experiences that make it really challenging to get a job or keep them in underemployment or make it challenging to come back after a period of absence. So people who've been to prison or who have criminal records, people who've experienced domestic violence or homelessness or addiction, these types of individuals whose, you know, talents are often overlooked or who just don't get a chance in the first instance to start a career. So they're the types of people we work with. You know, to give you like the spectrum is huge. So like the woman who inspired Radical is she's got 47 convictions. She's a black woman, a queer woman, born into a family of 16 siblings, not including her. Her parents were members of opposing gangs, born into, you know, generational poverty. Her mum used to starve her and beat her and do all sorts of awful things. Her father would involve her in his sort of prolific criminal activity. You know, by the age of 12, I think she'd had a gun held to her head and she had weapons charges. So this is the sort of person that we would support sort of at that very entry level early careers. So we've placed her four or five times in the last 5 years. She's now in a 60K head chef role.
Wow. So, okay. So yeah, let's slow this down, Emma, because like you're throwing a lot of information out here, which I'm still processing, because I think for anybody who is listening, who up until they heard your take, they may have thought that what they do is hard, that recruitment is hard, it's a hard job. But what you're describing sounds way harder than convincing a company to hire a salesperson or a programmer from, you know, a more traditional background. So can you say, in what way did this individual inspire you to launch this business? And can you say more about...
Yeah, the brand story. Yeah. I'd worked with sort of the underdogs of society for like 15 odd years in lots of different sort of charity roles, and became acutely aware of the fact that there were like 35,000 odd recruitment agencies registered as trading at the time I started Radical, but they were and remain largely inaccessible to sort of people who don't fit the popular mold. Anyway, before I founded Radical, I worked for an organization that supported women coming out of prison. That's where I met Chanel, the woman who inspired Radical. And in my first week, I was asked to give Chanel a call. She was residing at HMP Downview, which is a women's prison in Sutton, in Surrey. And she had about 6 weeks left on a 6-year sentence. She'd been incarcerated for arson and threats to kill. So two real big, big charges that would make it very difficult for her to find a job on the outside. And she'd never worked a legitimate job pre-prison. And by that stage, she'd spent about 10 years in prison. She was 25, 26 at the time. Anyway, my job, I was green, never had any experience recruiting, terrible at writing CVs, you know, all the stuff that you need to have in your back pocket if you want to be a decent recruiter. And I had a quick call with her, about 20 minutes on the phone, and she sort of downloaded her life to me. And she was talking about this social enterprise that she'd founded and was running from within the prison called Down the Cake Hole. So it turns out Chan was this amazing cook and had a real passion for baking. And she also had influence within the prison because she managed to convince the then governor to allow her to launch this social enterprise. And she was at the time catering events for him and other organizations coming into the prison, as well as some events outside of the prison that the prison would run. And I asked her the question, you know, why? Like, why this business? And she said, well, I wanted to leave a legacy in the prison. I wanted to ensure that I created opportunities for women who were serving life sentences to gain the skills they'd need to go out and work in hospitality post-release. And that's one of the challenges with prison leave is very often no one meets you at the prison gate. So that's where the real punishment starts, because you go out of the prison, you've got, you know, a 60-pound grant or something. They'll give you a sleeping bag, a bus ticket, very often on a Friday night, and no one meets you there to support you. You've got nowhere to go, no home, no family, no friends, you know, all this sort of thing. So really for Chanel, her only opportunity to turn her life around and sort of come out of that cycle of offending was to secure work and all the things that work offers, dignity, obviously, but also the opportunity to go get a home and, you know, this sort of thing. Anyway, was really struck by sort of her motivation. I thought, that's amazing. What a great reason to do this. And I asked her if she could cater an event that I was sort of coordinating in the prison that would happen a few weeks later, which she agreed to do. So we're bringing all these employers in to do like mock interviews with the women to help them get ready for work post-release. Anyway, she desperately wanted to work in food. That was incredibly obvious. She was very clever. She had all of these skills around sort of training other people. She was running the business, all this sort of thing. And so I cobbled together what I now know to be a really shit CV. I've had lots of practice since then. And I sent it to the head of people, Ollie, at Honest Burgers. He's not there anymore, but he was there for a number of years. And I said, you've got to come meet this woman. She's amazing. Come to this event. So he came to the event and she fed him a piece of her grandmother's recipe carrot cake. And he took a bite and the story goes, he said, it was the best fucking piece of carrot cake he'd ever eaten. And he asked, what are your job prospects on release? So Shan happened to be, going to Reading to a hostel supported. I use the word supported very loosely. There was no support, but a hostel, where she would be monitored and all this sort of thing. And, that was in Reading, and Ollie happened to be opening a new restaurant in Reading, and the open date and her release date coincided. So she went from being released to prison straight to Honest Burgers for an interview in her prison attire, got offered the job, and then moved, very quickly from sort of the dish pig, to, head chef in training. And then she's moved a couple of times since then and has now got a head chef ship, which is quite amazing given that she hadn't worked a day in her life pre-prison.
Wow. That's incredible. So then how did that lead you to launch the business, Radical?
Because we were talking at the Reward Gateway Engagement Excellence Summit about 18 or maybe 2 years later. She'd been out of prison for about, around 2 years, I think. And we were telling her story from our different perspectives, Ollie, Shannon and I, and she was sitting in front of a room of suits. It was a really corporate event. And she pitched this room and she was like, she was pleading with the audience to think differently about talent and to think about sort of the human and the moral case for recruiting from prison leaver backgrounds and just people who've not really had a chance to get started or who had made mistakes, and paid for them by going to prison. And the room, and she was saying things like, you know, I haven't, offended for 6 months. I've, you know, since my release, I'm now training to be blah, 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 and that. I've got a community I feel like I belong to. I've got a safe home. This is the first time in my life I've ever felt safe. And I thought, fucking hell, like it was a shit CV and one introduction to an employer who could see her potential, and a piece of carrot cake. And she turned her life around. I was just like, it was just one of these moments where I was like, I've got to do this for men in prison. I've got to do this for homeless folks. I've got to, you know, there are 90,000 male cells in the male estate. There are 14 million people with disabilities. There are 230,000 homeless folk in the UK. you know, domestic violence is, all these communities are just not getting good recruitment services because they have gaps on their CV and no one knows what to do with them because they're scary, you know.
Yeah. Emma, can I address that? Because that is the very first thing that occurred to me is like what you're describing. I mean, so Sherry, right? Was the Shan. Sorry. So Shan's story is sympathetic and you've given the backstory and the kind of context in which she grew up and everything. But the communities you're describing, especially the ex-offenders, that freaks me out. And that sounds like that's, I think, is a kind of without intellectually thinking it through, it's almost like a gut reaction.
It's totally a gut. Yeah.
Like there's a gut response of like, oh my God, I don't know if I could do that. Like what, I don't know if I've even ever met an ex-offender, let alone. Like, so you're working closely with people to help them improve their life circumstance. So, but are there, presumably there's people in that community that you wouldn't want to be in a room with or have anything to do with? Or do you just take people as they come and feel like, well, everyone deserves another chance? Like, what's your philosophy around this?
Yeah. I mean, I think my strong feeling is that the right to work should be inalienable because without work, you can't possibly live a good life. And, you know, people who are living in poverty are those that populate our prison system. So if we're really serious, whether we're politicians, charity leaders, business leaders about, community safety and coherence, about, human rights, about saving the public purse money economically, there's not one business case that doesn't make sense if you think about it. I would say to people whose gut reaction is, oh God, they're dangerous, they're scary. You know, would you hire Richard Branson? Would you hire Nelson Mandela? Of course you would, both ex-cons. So this, you know, stereotype, this sort of really negative perception of people who've been to prison, it's a blanket type perception that
for sure.
Everyone is tarred with, sadly. And really, a lot of the fear could be addressed if you knew the story behind the CV. I would also say to those business leaders or anyone really, unless you're DBS checking absolutely everyone who comes into your business and who's in your friendship circle and in your church group and, you know, all of these communities that we all belong to, it is very likely that you are either recruiting, in the process of recruiting someone who's got a conviction or have people on staff who have convictions. You've definitely got a friend who's got a conviction, I can guarantee it. You know, they're everywhere. There's 11 million people in the UK have a criminal conviction. 1 million of them have unspent convictions. I guess if you look at it through, you know, that real Hollywood lens, absolutely everyone with convictions are scary. But really, you know, the women, female state's full of women who have, you know, hidden guns under their beds under duress because their partner's dealing drugs. Or it could be that, you know, you received an image that is illegal and should have been reported, but you haven't reported it. You know, so there's a whole load of nuance. You've got people sitting in prison because they've stolen food for their kids, you know, or not paid their council tax. You know, these are the types of things that land people in prison. Ironically, people with very serious convictions are the least likely to reoffend. So statistically, if you've done 17 years for a murder, there's like a 0.004 chance that that person will reoffend because they've had the time to rehabilitate. They get huge amounts of clinical and other services to help them rehabilitate. Whereas someone who's got, say, a petty theft, you know, they've robbed a house to feed a drug habit, they go into prison, they do their 6 months and they get spat back out into the poverty that led them there in the first place, only to reoffend again because no one will give them a job and they're still in active addiction. So if you're thinking about like that fear factor, really the more serious the offense, the less likely they are to to reoffend.
Interesting. So what you're saying really, Emma, is that everyone's an individual, right? And we all have our own story, and we need to be aware of and avoid lumping whole groups of people in together. I guess that's common sense, right?
I think before that though, you really need, if you're an employer thinking about hiring ex-offenders, people with convictions, you really need to think carefully about like how robust your processes and your policies are. You can't de-risk people. Like, I mean, for all I know, Mark, you're a wife beater who hasn't been caught. And I'm a drug dealer. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't know.
Sure.
You wouldn't know because we haven't been caught yet. For the record, I don't deal drugs and I assume you're not a wife beater, Mark, but
correct.
Do you know what I mean? So if I walk into an interview, no one's thinking, oh gosh, she's selling drugs on the side. She's shot on Fridays. No,
right.
Of course not. So I think, the thing that's going to protect businesses is to ensure that you've got really robust policy and process and people who are recruiting who have the confidence to hear a disclosure and assess the risk associated with perhaps hiring that type of person with that type of disclosure for that type of role in that type of business. You get the point, don't you? So everything sort of on a case by case basis is what we would encourage. I think
Did you know that many of our listeners first heard of the Resilient Recruiter from a friend or colleague? Word of mouth really is the best form of advertising. So if you enjoy the show and get value from it, I'd be grateful if you would pay it forward by sharing it with others. Have a think for a moment. Who in your network might benefit from this podcast? Maybe a current or former colleague or a fellow member of a recruiting association? It would mean the world to me if you would drop them a quick email, text, or LinkedIn message with a link to the show. Thank you so much for your support. Now let's get back to the interview.
I think the other thing to know is that when you're working with an intermediary or a partner, whatever you want to call it, and you're tasking them with, fishing from that pool of talent, we have really, really stringent processes in terms of vetting not only the candidate's motivation to work and their capability to do the jobs that they're applying for, but also what got them there and what the barriers are and whether or not they've taken responsibility and removed those barriers so that the likelihood of them reoffending again is reduced significantly. So, when we have a candidate, when a radical comes and says, I've got a criminal conviction, we need to know that they've taken responsibility for that conviction. They've shown contrition, they've done the rehab bit, all of the things that led them there in the first place have been removed. So you've got processes and policies to de-risk the people rather than trying to de-risk the.
Makes sense. Emma, so so many questions. First of all, how did you get into this line of work?
No one in corporate would give me a job, Mark, because I swear too much. my mum, everything in my life that's not going to lead to any money or looking good is not joking. So I'm short because of my mum. Got back problems because of my mum. And I work in the charity sector. I'm going to be poor because of my mum. Definitely my mother. She had an open door policy as a kid. So she came from really poverty. When I was a kid. Yeah. Absolutely. Sorry. Yeah. So she lived in poverty. She was one of seven, siblings and her, mum was very unwell with bipolar. And they lived sort of well below the breadline. But she always had this like just ethos, I guess, or always taught us not explicitly, but we always sort of looked after people in our family. Right. And
by example, teaching by example.
Yeah. She did that by feeding the kids on the, in the neighborhood that, their parents were having a divorce or, we took a whole family in for months and months into our, this is just how my mom is. So I think, caring for people and, human rights and advocacy and all these things that my mom did a lot of informally are very important to me now. And it gives you a kick. Like there's something beautiful about, placing someone into work who has never really thought they were going to amount to anything because they've been told over and over and over by every system, every structure, every bloody institution that they're not good enough. So it is that's a beautiful thing too. That's what keeps me in it.
All right. It's good to understand what motivates you and inspires you. So coming back to the business then, what So Radical Recruit is a charity, right?
Yep.
And then you've got Be Radical, which is a profit for good consultancy. What does that mean?
Yeah, so we offer three core diversity services. So we do lots of work with executive teams around strategy and a good amount of work to capacity build those who will then go and execute the strategy, focusing on leaders of radical or what would be radical people, as well as recruitment and talent acquisition folk. So lots of unconscious bias training, lots of like copywriting for diversity, this sort of thing, as well as trauma-informed leadership training. We got a whole load of different modules or workshops. We also support with recruitment at that graduate level all the way up to key senior hires. So I'll give you an example. We worked with WPP not long ago, and placed 12 radicals. So a third were women, two thirds were global majority, and a third were disabled into WPP's IT transformation, department. And so they're on 3-year contracts. None of them had degrees. Oh, a couple of them had degrees, most of them didn't. And so we work with businesses to source talent that they're not going to find through their traditional means, and support them to think about designing really engaging, empowering recruitment processes that they can all participate in regardless of their different abilities. And then we support them to sort of start well and sustain their placement. So just shy of 2 years on, 11 are still in post. And then we also do like key senior hires. So an example, we worked with a tech company, a global tech company. They had a head of inclusion program manager, or a head of inclusions program. So I can't even say that. I don't know why I struggle with that every time I do it. I should rename the role really for podcast purposes, shouldn't I? Anyway, they wanted us to target people of colour, disabled folk, people who have had sort of experiences like homelessness and domestic violence. Anyway, we placed a 25-year-old care leaver who has brown skin, I'm not sure what her ethnicity is, into a role, into this 80K salary. She was on 40K in a similar role,
wow,
completely underemployed, and would never have sort of applied to that brand had it not have been for our endorsement, because there's no way she would have got a look in if we didn't sort of apply that sort of no salary history rule that we have, or policy that we have. And then the other thing we do a fair bit of is audits. So end-to-end audits through usually neurodivergent candidate lenses to look at that end-to-end process. Because very often what we find is that recommendations we make for neurodivergent humans are great for every human and have global application. So we focus on disability accessibility when we do our recruitment audits.
Wow, amazing. So how does this get monetized? Like, is it the corporations who are paying, and is it a traditional, like when for Radical Recruitment, are they paying an agency fee, or how is that?
Yeah, so we've just recently moved to a sponsorship model for the charity. So basically what we aim to do is tailor sponsorship packages that meet the partner's needs. So for example, it might be that, you know, we're working with Thameswater and I can't remember how much they paid, but they put some money in the pot and they got access. And we use that money to fund the employment scholarships of the radicals. And then they would have access to the alumni who have completed their employment scholarships, and then they go and recruit from that pool of talent at the very entry level. So apprenticeships, internships, you know, entry level office roles, a lot of that, and some field roles as well. They also bundled together some leadership the Radical Way, which is like trauma informed leadership training. So that was that package. We've got other clients who don't want to recruit radical talent because they're small businesses, but actually want to be doing some good. And want to, you know, promote our brand to their networks and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we've got, you know, very small one-man businesses who sponsor a radical and support that radical to move closer to the labour market. So that's a $3,000 package, 250 quid a month, buys a year's worth of support. And then there are opportunities for that radical to go and, I don't know, you know, do work placements, for example, or be mentored by the executive, or whatever it is that really works for both the radical and, oh, my hair's lovely, isn't it? the radical and the business that are sponsoring. So we just sort of bundle together whatever the sponsor needs to meet their sort of diversity or CSR or recruitment related problems. And then the other business is a sort of more traditional recruitment model. You pay for, you know, project costs, things like this.
Wow. Okay. That's super cool. And how, I mean, again, like this is a uneducated assumption that this would be challenging to sell, to get people to buy into, but like how receptive are companies to partnering with you?
I don't know whether I've gotten better at it or whether the landscape is sort of changing. There's not one executive in the world right now, if you ask them, is diversity on the top of your agenda? They're going to say no. You know, they're all talking the talk. I think the reality is that unless, you know, the executive sponsors this diversity work, unless it's properly resourced, unless there is, you know, a thoughtful, considered approach, unless people are measuring impact and linking it to the business case, you know, the work's probably not going to get done or done very well. So we're talking about, you know, organizations coming to Radical say we want to sort of recruit from this pool of talent, but very often they haven't appreciated the challenges that that pool of talent would face with regard to their specific recruitment process. So there is a need to really empathize with the challenge and accommodate individuals from X talent pool. That's not happening very often. So there's sort of a will to recruit, you know, radicals, but actually very often not the time, not the resource, not the will to go and accommodate them so that they would really flourish in the usual process. And that's the bit that's missing, I think, as far as sort of executives are concerned and businesses are concerned. They're saying the right things, but they're not doing the work necessarily to make it happen in a really safe way for the business and in a way that's going to be awesome for the candidates that they're wanting to recruit into their teams.
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. Emma, when I was researching you, and actually the way we found you is through your LinkedIn content, which is fantastic, by the way. So I would recommend anyone listening to go and check out Emma.
Thanks.
Freivogel's LinkedIn profile. But so let me spell that. It's Freivogel. And you get a huge amount of engagement. I mean, you're a great storyteller and you tell really compelling stories in a very effective way. And you get a lot of engagement on this. One that jumped out at me was something you posted about a year ago. Could you tell the story about, I think his name is Malcolm. He was a homeless person. Would you share that story? Because that was a powerful one.
Yeah, Malcolm was one of the first radicals I placed. Again, and he went into Honest Burgers, actually. So he was in that first cohort when Radical partnered with them. Yeah, I mean, Malcolm was just this sweet man. He was just, I mean, he wouldn't have said boo to a goose, very demure, very quiet, reserved, really struggled to make eye contact, just looked embarrassed all the time, you know. And he was referred to me by a charity in Southwark. He was rough sleeping at the time, and he had the reason he ended up on the streets was actually because his father died suddenly, and his whole world just was turned upside down, and his family splintered completely and utterly after that, and he turned to alcohol to sort of numb the pain. That self-medication turned into sort of an addiction, which took over his life really. And he ended up on the streets and had been in and out of prison for squatting and all sorts of things related to street life. And when I met him, he hadn't worked. He didn't have a CV. I mean, he couldn't look at me in the eye. He was sleeping in a hostel. I mean, I wouldn't let my dog sleep in a hostel. Most hostels, they're bloody awful places, a general rule, not very safe. I supported him for about 6 weeks on all things confident. And this is when I was a one-woman show. Like I was begging for referrals. Found out that he desperately wanted to work. He just didn't have any support around him. And the thing that was missing really was a home. It's very hard to get a job without a home.
Can't even imagine how many obstacles that, you know, would be in the way of you actually getting a job. So I can imagine that's a vicious cycle. What was that process that you took him through and what was the outcome?
I worked with, the local authority set up so that homeless people should in theory get the support they need to come off the streets and move into, transitional sort of, or temporary accommodation and then into homes. But obviously if you're a young man, you don't get a single man with no kids, you don't really get priority. So, there's a lot of advocacy, that I did with social services, because if you don't know how to navigate the system, you don't know your rights, it's very difficult to be seen or heard, a sea of people who desperately need help. So that was sort of the first point. We did a lot of work around employability, like what is it that you're interested in? What sort of work would you like to do? What skills have you got? He's creative. So, he was teaching himself how to code at some point. He was an amazing artist. I just wanted to sort of, you know, use his hands and be creative. So cobbled together a CV, did a whole load of interview prep with the help of some amazing volunteers. Popped him in the running for a prep chef type role at Honest Burgers. He got on really well with the head chef. They hit it off and he worked there until he was made redundant in the pandemic. We sadly lost contact after that. In terms of like post-placement support, lots of contact just to make sure that things were going as smoothly as they could at work and that there was no sort of need for support there. And also that, you know, his accommodation was sustained and his benefits were sorted and his debt was cleared and all this sort of stuff that makes it possible to keep carrying on, you know, keep going to work, retain accommodation, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, a really holistic offering. It wasn't, I didn't know what I was doing back then. I was just giving it a go, but it worked.
Wow.
It's working. It's better nowadays, that's for sure.
So fast forward to today, Emma, then what's the size and structure of the organization and what are your, like, what's the vision for the future?
Yeah. So with Be Radical, we're very much in startup mode. I co-founded that with two other amazing women. They're amazing, less so me probably. We work, there's about one and a half of us in that business at any given time. So you can appreciate growing that's really challenging because we're also running the charity together as a leadership team. To get through the next 6 months would be good. I'm told most startups fail in the first 2 years. We've got 6 months left. Fingers crossed, please, Mark.
You'll make it.
And we'd like to be sort of the go-to diversity and ESG partner for businesses big and small, you know, who are wanting to actually do something about their commitment to diversity, need a bit of help. The charity is a significantly bigger team in the sense that we've got six trustees who govern us. They're all radical in their own right, including Shan. She's on our board. And then we have a team of, it's Holly, Kirsty, myself, as well as two paid staff members who were radicals. Alicia was formerly homeless. She was homeless when I met her. And Chris had been to prison. So started as radicals. They've been with me for 4.5 years. And then we've got this army of amazing volunteers. I think it's around 700 volunteers. Wow. Who we mobilize each week. And they're individuals who do what we call the grunt work. So we get them on Zoom calls and in-person events and they roll up their sleeves and do mock interviews and CV surgeries and all of this really cool stuff that builds confidence and makes people feel like they're a part of a community and they're supported and they're valuable and that they can. So that, like, our volunteers are the secret sauce of Radical. They're the backbone. So that's how that team is structured.
Amazing. And from a leadership point of view, Emma, so what I'm looking for next are the, what you're doing is inspiring and quite incredible. And what I'm looking for are the parts that are transferable to other businesses, organizations, and leaders. Like, What have you learned in your journey so far that, you know, that you think is relevant to all business owners and leaders?
That's a good question. I think from a diversity perspective, if we treated diversity as seriously as we do things like financial resilience and mitigating the risk of cyber attacks and this sort of thing, then we would not have a problem filling roles at any level or with diversity of the diversity of the our businesses. It's just because it would be properly resourced. You'd have sponsorship from the top. It would be everybody's, you know, responsibility, blah, blah, blah. So I think that's the one big thing is like, if you're going to do, you know, claim to care about diversity, you need to treat it with the seriousness you would cybersecurity or, you know, whatever, fundraising or whatever. So that's one thing. I think that if leaders could just be more human-centric generally, not with regard to the way they view and interact with radical talent, but just people in general, we're all looking for the same things. We all benefit from the same things. So, you know, very often we'll be working with a company, for example, and they're wanting to make their recruitment process more accessible to candidates who are neurodivergent. At the end of the, you know, the audit process, we have, you know, spit out all of these amazing recommendations that actually, if implemented, would benefit every single human. And if you strip it all back, what we're saying is, how can we as a business make this experience more comfortable? How can we as a business empower and enable you to fulfill your potential in this experience? In the same way that you could ask that same question for someone who's onboarding, or someone who's, you know, at a support and supervision. It's like, how do we get the best out of you as an individual with all your needs considered, with all of your strengths considered, with all your preferences, blah, 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 considered. And I think if we took that approach in business, we would have far happier teams and we would be a far happier society because we spend so much time at work. You know, it's important to feel cared for. It's important to feel empowered and enabled, and you get far better engagement from your people. So that's another thing that I think, you know, we should be paying more attention to. How do we get the best out of our people? Treat them like the humans they are.
That is 100%. I can get on board with that for sure. Emma, this has been so interesting. How can people learn more about your work and What would be the next step if people wanted to reach out to you and find out more?
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, I think there's, if you're looking to recruit from radical talent pools that you're not connecting with or who aren't making it through your process, your usual process, then both businesses can help. So Be Radical supports businesses that hire talent at that sort of graduate early careers level all the way up to senior hires. The charity supports businesses who want that entry-level recruitment. So in terms of recruitment, you can get in touch with me, emma@radicalrecruit.co.uk or emma@beradical.co.uk. I'm on LinkedIn as well. In terms of things like audits and training, again, reach out on email, that's fine, or on LinkedIn. What we tend to do is sort of have a conversation about what they think the problems are. Very often they don't know what they are. We help them define them, and then we sort of ideate solutions and ways of working. So it generally starts a conversation. Give us a hoi.
Emma, it's been so fascinating meeting you. Thank you so much. I'm glad that we made it happen, and I'm going to continue to be a fan of your LinkedIn content. So thanks for...
Thank you, mate. I'm really glad to meet you, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out some of my other episodes. You'll see one or two suggested episodes on the screen now.